Hello, this is Dave Emery, and my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 365, side one. It's titled The Ties That Bind, part four, and this is called Geopolitics and September 11th. And we're going to proceed directly into the bulk of the broadcast due to the fact that there have been so many other programs on this subject due to the admitted complexity of the subject. And by the way, this is being recorded on June 24th of the year 2002. I'm not going to go into any sort of lengthy explanation of geopolitics, but rather I am going to cite the other broadcasts in this series and note the fact that there are detailed annotated descriptions of all of the programs on September 11th on the Spitfire website in the For the Record section. Those are numbers 325 and up. They constitute a book in and of itself, or in and of themselves at this point, and it is a work in progress. We're going to kick off the discussion by reading a section from the book All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin. This book was published in 1950 by Little Brown and Company in Boston. James Stewart Martin was in charge of the economic warfare section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice in World War II. As such, he was in charge with attempting to neutralize the cartel agreements that had grown up during the pre-World War II and World War II years between powerful elements of German heavy industry and finance and many of their counterparts in the United States, including the Morgan Group, Morgan Industrial and Financial Group elements that coalesced into the political milieu that ultimately spawned George W. Bush and his father, essentially the Morgan Industrial Group, their investment banking arm associated with the Harrimans, and some of their management specialists associated with Dylan Reed. Now, in his discussion of his attempts at not only interdicting the German-American cartel agreements, which boosted Nazi Germany and also restricted the United States, James Stewart Martin also had some observations about the continuity between German heavy industry and finance in the pre-World War II and Nazi period, and also the pre-World War II and World War II period, and the post-war period as well. And James Stewart Martin noted that he had been unsuccessful at interdicting these particular arrangements. I'm going to give a brief discussion of geopolitics. Suffice it to say that September 11th is a highly complex event and has been either completely misunderstood or impartially or incorrectly represented due to a great many things, and including the fact that an awful lot of people, frankly, can't or won't think. But this is a highly complex event and involves a number of different levels of analysis and a number of different connections, including elements that have led to conspiratorial cover-ups that were not necessarily overtly conspiratorial to begin with, at least not in a violent way, but rather some supra-political economic relationships have come into sharp view as a result of September 11th. I would also note that this constitutes in many ways a continuation of the Second World War, and I think that heavy industrial and financial elements associated with the Third Reich in its post-World War II underground phase are in the process of not only attacking, albeit in many ways economically, the United States, but I think that the United States is currently in a situation very much like France prior to and during World War II. There were strong relationships between French heavy industry and French finance, and in turn, many elements of the French power elite associated with the aristocracy, the general staff, as well as the Catholic Church, were bitterly opposed to a center-left democratic government under Léon Blum, known as the Popular Front, and many of them were actively conspiring with Nazi Germany and, to a lesser extent, Mussolini's Italy, because they saw fascism as a relatively desirable alternative to what they viewed as highly undesirable democratic elements, democratic with a small d, in their own country. That accounted in many ways for the rapid demise of the French military in World War II. Basically, they were sold out from the outside. And I think, to make a very long story very short, I do not believe that September 11th was a provocation, but rather, this is what you would be seeing. Imagine if Hitler had been in the White House when Pearl Harbor was attacked. that's what you would be seeing, because that, in my opinion, is what is going on. And I'm going to detail some of the entanglements, some of the ties that bind in the geopolitical landscape in and around September 11th. Turning now, by way of preface, to All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin, published in 1950 by Little Brown Books. Talking about his experience in Nazi Germany, or post-war Germany, and observing the continuity in corporate and financial structure, as well as, to a certain extent, political structure in post-war Germany. Our observations in post-war Germany did not support the theory that the Nazi regime was a runaway affair. Propaganda has been turned out in an effort to convince people that the industrialists who backed the Hitler coup did not realize they were opening a Pandora's box. We are to believe that the troubles they set loose plagued them no less than the rest of mankind. On the contrary, from all that we could gather in talking with German industrialists, the big industry group in Germany regrets the Hitler period only because the Nazis lost the war. We found no evidence that the leading industrial groups had acquired a fundamental distaste for German nationalism as such. And, of course, he was writing here in 1950, they are still working toward the organization of Europe in such a way as to support a dominant German industrial economy and the organization of Germany's own economic life around a concentration of heavy industries. Translation, take a look at the year 2002 with the European Monetary Union and the EU, both dominated by Germany. Continuing. Except for its military outcome, the Nazi experiment appears to have been a success in the eyes of its original sponsors. The unity of German business and finance in backing the Nazis was matched only by the precision in which the Nazi government moved in to support the aims and interests of the dominant financiers and industrialists. They, in turn, have been waging a hard post-war fight to keep the economic lines of the Nazi system intact. Then in this next paragraph, James Stewart Martin talks a little bit about geopolitics. Bear in mind one of the political geopolitical tenets of the worldview that spawned the Nazis. That is, they took a look at the world and they saw the giant landmass extending from the Straits of Gibraltar in Spain all the way across Europe through the former Soviet Union, embracing most of the Middle East, India, and Pakistan. That's one giant landmass that they called the Earth Island. It also embraces most of the world's petroleum reserves with the Middle East and the former Soviet Central Asian states. And right across the middle of that was a huge block of Muslim population. They saw controlling that Muslim population as an ally or as a subject as the key to not only controlling the Earth Island and most of the world's landmass, but also controlling most of the world's petroleum reserves. That was seen as the key to world domination. Turning again to James Stewart Martin's All Honorable Men. The Nazi effort came as near to military success as it did because German military planners took advantage of the lessons of geopolitics. The relation of strategically placed landmasses and national resources to the control over larger areas of the Earth's surface had been studied with great care not only by Professor Karl Haushofer and his Geopolitical Institute, but by a great number of other German scientists, economists, and political analysts. In the same way, the German planners shaped the economic war not only as a supplement to military operations, but as a substitute to hedge against military defeat. The German high command made use of what we might call eco-political organizations, combining both economic and political forces under common control. Though they had no eco-political institute labeled as such, the Germans arranged the strategic control of large areas of economic activity both at home and abroad by maintaining control of bottleneck points. It was this feature of the cartel system that General Clay and his economic advisors tended to ignore, placing their chief emphasis on so-called war potential. Unquote. The German eco-political organizations, IG Farben, Vereinigte Stahlwerke or United Steel, the Deutsche Bank, and Dresdner Bank and all the rest, did not die with the dismemberment of the German military machine. No, indeed, they continued their existence, and as we have seen many times, They coalesced in the post-war into the Bormann Organization, as I have called it, basically the economic and political component of a Third Reich gone underground, also functioning in connection with the Heinrich Müller intelligence outfit. Heinrich Müller, the chief of the Gestapo, and the security coordinator for the Bormann Organization. We have in the past many times accessed the landmark work of Paul Manning and his book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, drawn on U.S. Treasury Department documents, FBI files, OSS files, and many other sources of documentation. Paul Manning, who was part of Edward R. Murrow's group in World War II, trained as a gunner and flew air combat missions into Europe to cover the air war in Europe, broadcast the surrender of Germany on the CBS radio network, then trained as a gunner aboard a B-29 to cover combat missions over Japan, flew those combat missions over Japan, and then broadcast the surrender of Japan on the CBS radio network as well from the deck of the USS Missouri. So noting geopolitics, and as I've said before, noting some of the ties that bind, we are going to take a look at some of the complexities, some of the entanglements, and some of the ties that are binding the United States and its people to what I think is frankly a course for disaster. And as much of a threat as nuclear terrorism and Al-Qaeda may be, and there are strong connections between Al-Qaeda and the Wahhabi sect and what I call the Underground Reich, as devastating or more devastating will be the Bush tax cuts, the Maginot missile shield, as I call it, something that is going to bleed valuable U.S. resources, including needed military resources, into something that is going to be very much like the Maginot line for France in World War II, hugely expensive and altogether ineffective in meeting the threats that are to come. Ultimately, the U.S. current accounts deficit is something that is very likely to destroy the United States. As background reading to some of the things that I'm talking about, I would suggest The Prince by Niccolo Machiavelli, The Art of War by Sun Tzu, and the text On War by Prussian military theoretician Karl von Clausewitz. That's not exactly light bedside reading, but I would suggest those as documents for background understanding. Now, one of the ties that bind and is binding is the tie between the U.S., the Republican political establishment, Saudi Arabia, and the Wahhabi sect. The Wahhabi sect is an Islamo-fascist permutation of Islam that is not only at variance with much of what the Prophet Muhammad had to say, but which has been boosted into a position of primacy within the Islamic world because of petrodollars. And the ties between, on the one hand, Saudi Arabia and the Underground Reich, going all the way back to the founding of Saudi Arabia and people like Jack Philby and Alan Dulles, right on up to the present, where one has strong connections between the Muslim Brotherhood, the milieu of François Janoux, people like Ahmed Huber, Youssef Nada, and the international funding networks that funded not only Al-Qaeda but other forms of Wahhabi terrorism. In turn, those are bound to George Bush and the Republican Party through the Ethnic Outreach Organization and through the petroleum industry, as well as the fact that there are hundreds of billions of dollars invested by Saudi Arabia in the United States economy directly. There are, in turn, very lucrative contracts between American corporations and Saudi Arabia. The Saudis hold much of America's foreign debt in terms of T-bills, and in turn, Saudi Arabia has heavily invested in American academic and nonprofit institutions. One of the things that got me doing the type of work that I do in the way that I do it was the fact that I would begin reading, I would do reading and I would relate things to people and they would flat out tell me that couldn't be true. So I started saving the articles and reading them to people, and that was convincing in a way that I was unable to be in other ways. The following article is an example of that. Wall Street Journal, Thursday, June 13th of 2002, article by Greg Jaffe, Saudis strengthen ties with U.S. military. Stateline, Washington, subtitled, After a rupture, Kingdom moves quietly on two issues, boon to effort against Iraq. Skipping down. Another factor is Saudi Arabia's internal politics, which require the royal family to carefully balance security needs with the sentiment of Saudi citizenry, many of whom dislike the U.S. military presence on the peninsula. Quote, "Once they realized they had scared us too much, they started to edge back the other way," unquote, a senior U.S. Navy official said, again quoting, "They realized they had taken things too far," unquote. Well, this unnamed Navy official, no doubt, was simply avoiding a court-martial, which he would get if he criticized George Bush. But this is surreal. This is rather like almost an equivalent statement that the Japanese bombed us a little too much at Pearl Harbor, but now they're edging back the other way, and we're getting along better with them now. After all, we don't want to louse up the toy business. Not altogether different. Noting the connections between what I call the Wahhabi Lobby and the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. This is a milieu that binds the milieu of Al-Qaeda, the milieu of Osama bin Laden, and the Republican Party's Ethnic Outreach Organization, in the past a repository for Central and Eastern European fascist elements such as Iron Guard, Ustashi, the Bulgarian National Front, Baltic, and Ukrainian Waffen-SS units. And the Ethnic Outreach Organization, spawned by Alan Dulles, Richard Nixon, the elder George Bush, and William Casey, in its genesis had Ronald Reagan as a front man for the Crusade for Freedom. And noting some of the Wahhabi lobby connections to the Republican Party as well as to the petroleum industry, consider the following. This was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This is by BBC journalist Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T, or Palast, I've heard it pronounced. This was originally published in The Guardian of London on Wednesday, November 7th of 2001. It can be accessed at www.gregpalast.com, G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T.com. And this will be the URL will be fully noted in the printed description for FTR 365. This article, FBI and U.S. spy agents say Bush spiked bin Laden probes before September 11th. It's by Greg Palast and David Pallister. FBI and military intelligence officials in Washington say they were prevented for political reasons from carrying out full investigations into members of the bin Laden family in the U.S. before the terrorist attacks of September 11th. U.S. intelligence agencies have come under criticism for their wholesale failure to predict the catastrophe at the World Trade Center. But some are complaining that their hands were tied. By the way, I would note, among other factors in FTR 362, allegations that are taking shape that Enron had been brokering the Caspian Sea pipeline deal on behalf of U.S. Oil companies, that the bin Laden family had been promised a portion of that deal. There's substantive evidence not only that this was the case, but this was apparently known to Mohammed Atef, the chief of operations for Al-Qaeda from 1998 on, and this may very well have played a role in helping to bind the hands of American intelligence. As John Loftus noted, this was not an intelligence failure, but it was a policy failure. Again, the ties that bind. Continuing. FBI documents shown on BBC Newsnight last night and obtained by The Guardian show that they had earlier sought to investigate two of Osama bin Laden's relatives in Washington and a Muslim organization, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, with which they were linked. The FBI file, marked secret and coded 199, which means a case involving national security, records that Abdullah bin Laden, who lived in Washington, had originally had a file opened on him, quote, because of his relationship with the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, a suspected terrorist organization, unquote. WAMY members deny that they have been involved with terrorist activities, and WAMY has not been placed on the latest list of terrorist organizations whose assets are being frozen. Abdullah, who lived with his brother Omar at the time in Falls Church, Virginia, a town just outside Washington, was the U.S. director of WAMY, whose offices were in a basement nearby. By the way, this was discussed in For the Record 356. Continuing. But the FBI files were closed in 1996, apparently before any conclusions could be reached on either the bin Laden brothers or the organization itself. High-placed intelligence sources in Washington told The Guardian this week, quote, "There were always constraints on investigating the Saudis," unquote. They said the restrictions became worse after the Bush administration took over this year. The intelligence agencies had been told to, quote, back off, unquote, from investigations involving other members of the bin Laden family, the Saudi royal family, and possible Saudi links to the acquisition of nuclear weapons by Pakistan. There were particular investigations that were effectively killed, unquote. Then after talking about the fact that WAMY did have some respectable branches, but the article continues skipping down, but as long as 10 years ago, it was named as a discrete channel for public and private Saudi donations to hardline Islamic organizations. One of the recipients of its largesse has been the militant Students Islamic Movement of India, which has lent support to Pakistani-backed terrorists in Kashmir and seeks to set up an Islamic state in India. Since September 11th, WAMY has been investigated in the U.S. along with a number of other Muslim charities. There have been several grand jury investigations, but no findings have been made against any of them. And again, we dealt with that at greater length in FTRs 356, 357, 358, 9, and 62. The following concerns disclosures this past week that the National Security Agency had a couple of intercepts of Al-Qaeda operatives. These were apparently not translated not fully taken stock of before September 11th. But what is interesting is where these Al-Qaeda operatives were, or the place they were communicating with. This is from USA Today of Thursday, June 20th of 2002, an article by John Diamond and Kathy Kiley of USA Today. This is Dateline Washington headlined, Heard 910, Tomorrow is Zero Hour. Intercepts by NSA, translated September 12th. It reads in part, conversations intercepted the day before September 11th caught Al-Qaeda operatives boasting in Arabic, quote, the match begins tomorrow, unquote, and tomorrow is zero hour, unquote. But U.S. intelligence didn't translate them until September 12th, congressional and administration sources disclosed Wednesday. Skipping down, and this refers to Air Force Lieutenant General Michael Hayden, the head of the NSA, Hayden told the lawmakers the intercepts captured Al-Qaeda members communicating with allies in Saudi Arabia, according to one of the officials. So again, note where these Al-Qaeda operatives were apparently using as a, to a certain extent, a mid-level command center. Again, Saudi Arabia. More on that same connection, the LA Times of that same day, Thursday, June 20th of 2002, an article by Josh Meyer and Janet Hook and Eric Lichtblau, Dateline Washington, skipping down about the NSA intercepts. This was an example that something was up, the official said, of the September 10th calls, but it doesn't tell you where it was, what it was, or how we could stop it, unquote. Which is in and of itself true. But what is interesting, again, is that apparently investigations were interdicted. And note what else has been taken note of. U.S. officials said last fall that Osama bin Laden had telephoned his wife and his mother in Damascus, Syria, on September 10th. He reportedly urged his wife to return to Afghanistan and told his mother she would not hear from him for a long time, unquote. And again, the Saudi connections here are some of the ties that bind. I have noted in many of the broadcasts the German connections to September 11th. These are being obscured to a tremendous extent. For the record, 331 dealt with these, as did for the record number 336. And through Germany, the underground Reich, institutions like Al-Taqwa or NADA management, people like Yusef Nada, Ahmed Huber, we have strong historical and economic and to a certain extent operational links between the Third Reich, the Underground Reich, Al-Qaeda, and the Wahhabi lobby. One of the things that I think is indicative of the geopolitical struggle going on now between the United States and the Underground Reich, and that is some of the intelligence conflicts between the U.S. and Germany. Bear in mind that the 54 Marienstrasse Hamburg address that was used as the base by the pivotal Hamburg cell was under surveillance by German intelligence. Also bear in mind that it is perfectly legal under German law for people who have emigrated to the country under religious auspices to plan and execute terrorist acts as long as they are not against Germans or on German soil. That, as I said, is what you call homeland security. New York Times, Tuesday, June 11th, 2002, Stephen Erlanger writes as follows, Germany says Qaeda figure was never in country. Intelligence officials in Washington have not responded to requests for information about a visit to Germany by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, an operative for al-Qaeda who has emerged as a central figure in the September 11th attacks, German officials said today. They added that their own checks had turned up no trace of Mr. Mohammed's ever visiting or living here. The officials said they had first heard from the American press, not American officials, about a possible visit by Mr. Mohammed to Hamburg in 1999. Their own requests for information have not been answered, the senior German officials said, expressing annoyance at the way information was apparently leaked by the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington. They suggested that in trying to deflect the blame for intelligence failures, the American agencies may be unfairly pointing the finger at German officials, skipping down. We have no record of him living in Germany, a senior German intelligence official said, and we have no information about him visiting Germany in 1999, skipping down again. While the German authorities shared what they knew about Mr. Moussaoui with the FBI and CIA on an informal investigative basis, the Germans and the French have balked at providing evidence that could eventually serve to execute Mr. Moussaoui. Skipping down. Or actually, let's continue. For example, the Germans have the original bank transfer documents used to get money to Mr. Moussaoui and said to bear Mr. Shebe's fingerprints, but they have thus far provided Washington only copies. The copies would not be admissible in court. Again, note the struggle here between the United States, Germany, and the underground Reich. German officials say that al-Qaeda is regrouping in Europe and elsewhere and that cells are planning attacks on softer, more localized targets that will not necessarily be in the United States. And skipping down again, the official noted the German raids in April to break up a group known as al-Tawid, led by Ahmad Fadiq al-Khalilaya, known as Abu Masab al-Zarqawi, a top figure in al-Qaeda now living in Iran. The group, which is based in London, quote, had begun to plan attacks in Germany, unquote, the federal prosecutor's office said. We're going to talk more about the ongoing friction between U.S. and German intelligence. I think that what the dominant dynamic here is not so much an attempt by U.S. intelligence officials to deflect responsibility as the fact that we are literally looking at a continuation of World War II, albeit in an underground and complex fashion. And very few critics have taken note of the German culpability in September 11th. The various tapes and CDs that I've done over the years are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They are located at P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, 95005. The email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And there are detailed annotated descriptions of the various For the Record programs, including at this point a book length. A compilation of descriptions of the programs on September 11th. That is For the Record 325 and up, and those are in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Sister station WFMU-FM has been compiling the For the Record programs on Real Audio. There are two websites, wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y, and a longer URL that has older programs available for download only. Please note that Spitfire has the two most recent pair of half-hour segments available on Real Audio for approximately a week after each of these broadcasts is recorded. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 365, The Ties That Bind, Part 4, Geopolitics, in September 11th. This is being recorded on June 24th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.